Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect introduces David Lepofsky, the chair of the AODA Alliance, and we're going to talk today about the AODA and the Ontario's government's hankering for input in the next 2 weeks. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, good. Now, you're almost, maybe, I don't know about legally, but you've got, I think, an Order of Canada to substantiate it. You're almost the father of the AODA, aren't you?
I don't claim parental in the rules.
Okay.
But I have been involved in the movement that advocated for this legislation since we started back in 1994.
Okay, good.
And now I have the privilege of, in a volunteer capacity, of leading the coalition that's of people from across the community who are trying to get the law effectively implemented. It took us 10 years of fighting to get the law passed. Now we're trying to get it effectively implemented. We've been doing that for close to 6 years.
All right. And for people who are interested in taking part in this, where would they go?
Well, the two things I'm going to tell you about are about us, if they want to get involved with us, mm-hmm. and also about giving feedback to the government. We are a non-government coalition. We have no money, and we don't ask for money, and we don't want money. We're just volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
You can sign up for our email updates by writing us at an email address, which I'll give in a minute. People can get ready to write it down. And you can also learn about what we are doing from our website.
Okay.
So I'll give you the email address. It's aodafeedback at gmail.com.
Okay.
And our website is aodaalliance, that's one word, .org.
Okay.
So those are the two things, aodafeedback@gmail.com. You just write letters saying, can I sign up for emails, and we'll put you on our list. And by the way, we don't ever give our list out to anyone,
right?
Any third party, and we only sign people up if they themselves ask.
So I can't blame you for the Viagra ads.
Sorry.
Can't do it.
And you can see our past updates on our AODA Alliance website, the whole history of our movement, of our efforts.
Okay. Before we get going, perhaps we should just, in 25 words or less, tell people who may be tuning in who are not disabled or who have been disabled so long they've been out of this loop, what is the AODA?
Okay. Well, starting about 16 years ago, a lot of us folks with disabilities, I happen to be blind, but people with a physical disability or a sensory disability or a mental disability, a whole lot of us thought that we needed a new law to tear down the barriers that we face when we try to either get a job or use public services, get on public transit, or go buy goods in a store. And so we wanted a law where we didn't have to sue about the barriers we face every day, one barrier at a time. And so we campaigned for a new law, and that law was passed in 2005. It's called the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. And it's unlike most other laws in Ontario because it didn't come from the political parties or from policy experts at the government. It was really the product of a movement of people with disabilities and people who care about people with disabilities all around Ontario. We're nonpartisan. We don't subscribe to any party. We don't try to elect or defeat anybody. We just try to advocate for removing the barriers facing people with disabilities. And just, in a word, the law says that Ontario has to become fully accessible by 2025. And it puts in place a process where the government has to make rules, enforceable rules, on what barriers have to be torn down and when.
Right.
And that's in a nutshell what it is, so that we don't want to have to bring human rights complaints against barriers one at a time.
Right.
And barriers aren't just steps to get in a bus or a building that someone in a wheelchair can't ascend. A barrier that I personally fought was after riding buses and subways in Toronto and not being able to find out what bus stop I'm at because I'm blind, I had to sue the TTC, the Toronto Transit Commission, to force them to announce all bus and subway stops.
Right.
And I won that those cases, but it was a lot of work. We want a rule that says to all transit authorities, hey, drivers, call the stops.
Yeah.
And that's an example of a barrier relating to a sensory disability. We're also interested in barriers facing people with mental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, mental health issues, and so on.
I think lawyers who don't deal in disability law, and that's 99.9% of them, mistake accessibility for a physical issue, and I think probably the general public does, too.
That's true. When you say barrier or accessibility, most people think you're just talking about a wheelchair getting up a flight of stairs, and that's an important barrier problem or accessibility problem, but we're talking about technological barriers. You know, when you go to a store and they have an electronic kiosk that we can't use to make your transaction, that's a barrier.
All right.
The government created this Presto smart card for public transit,
right,
but it's got barriers facing people with certain disabilities, including vision disabilities. They actually used our tax dollars to create barriers in how we pay for public transit. It's astonishing, but it's still going on.
Okay. All right. So you are carrying on this initiative to remove these barriers. What's going on right now?
Well, the main way that the law is supposed to be implemented, the government's supposed to develop accessibility standards in different sectors of our economy that says what barriers have to go, who's got to remove them by when. And they're not supposed to be one-size-fits-all solutions. There's supposed to be a recognition that, for example, government may be expected to act more quickly. Then the private sector, big business may have to do more than smaller local mom-and-pop operations, and big business may also have to act more quickly. So the government set about to develop access standards in a number of areas, and they picked, the McGuinty government picked good areas. Three of them were barriers to transportation. That's really a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
And public transportation, because if you can't get into public transit, you know, you can't get to work, you can't get to school. It's a real problem. You can't get to your doctor. The second area is barriers to employment.
Mm-hmm.
And the third area is barriers to information and communication. You know, trying to get websites that folks who are blind can read using their access technologies, proper supports for communication supports for people who are deaf when they go to the hospital, and
all right,
so on. So the government spent several years getting input on developing standards in those three areas. They finally have now released for public comment their near final draft of what they're proposing. And it's up for public comment. You can see it on our website. It's also on the Ontario government's website. But if you go to aodaalliance.org,
mm-hmm,
and you go to the What's New page, you'll see the very top link right there will take you right to a downloadable, accessible Microsoft Word version of this thing.
Okay.
And they're asking for input on this by March 18th. Now, we at the AODA Alliance, we've been gathering input from the community for years on this and putting forward briefs and proposals all along the way. They're all up on our websites. And now we're down to the end game, if you will. So we are right now in the middle of putting together a series of proposals for amendments to this regulation that we're going to be presenting to the government in the next couple of weeks and urging them to listen to us. Now,
what are the limits to this regulation? I mean, what does it purport to affect, and what does it not purport to affect?
Well, it's trying to affect those three areas, accessibility,
okay,
and employment.
So if you have a problem in another area, that shouldn't concern you at this time.
The three areas, employment, transportation, information, and communications.
All right.
And you know, in fairness to the government, and I've been critical for the government on a number of things, including the fact that this proposed standard is way too weak, but they did pick three important areas, and they are... It's a lot of work. You can't just pull these things out of the air. You want to do it, and you want to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we're now in the middle of saying, okay, you've got a proposal on the table, government. Here are the wording changes we need to make it strong and effective.
All right. And so people should put their individual input into the government, but it sounds like you're soliciting input as well.
Yeah,
it sounds
exactly.
Like they should copy it to you or something.
Yeah, we would encourage people to write that email address, aodafeedback@gmail.com, and give us your thoughts. What we've been doing over these years is all the way along is getting input and ideas, and we use those to build on our proposals. And then once we get our brief submit it. We'll make it public. It'll be going out on our email list. It'll go up on our website. We encourage people to write the government, and if they agree with us, to endorse our brief and also add their own two bits. You know, okay. And if they don't agree with us, they should tell the government why they don't agree with us, too. It's a democracy, and we want everybody
to be heard. Well, everybody's disability is a little bit different, so, yeah.
Yeah, and we don't claim to have a monopoly on good ideas. We just try to get as many good ideas from as many people as we can. I can give you a couple examples of where the thing needs improvement.
If
they help you. I'll give you sort of three or four that are really important. One of them is a couple are in the area of public transportation.
Yeah.
There's a real problem that in a number of communities, or in every community that has a public transportation system, a conventional one, there are people because of their mobility limitations or otherwise, they can't ride the conventional system. There are stairs, there are steps, and so on. So various cities, like Hamilton or Toronto or whatever, have what's called paratransit. It's a parallel transit where they have accessible vehicles that pick up people with disabilities.
Right.
Now, here's the problem. The problem is this. If you, I'm talking to you from Toronto. If I go out on one of the major streets here to get a bus during the day, I wait 10 minutes, there's a bus.
Right.
I don't have to call. I don't have to book it. I don't have to wait on hold for hours. I don't have to do anything. I just go out there and wait for the bus. And if there's traffic, it'll be a few minutes late, but most you have to wait is a few minutes off the schedule.
Yeah.
You know, except in the odd sort of calamity. But that's, a blizzard or something.
Mm-hmm.
Paratransit, we've been asking them to, paratransit riders often have to phone up. They book a ride. Sometimes in Toronto, they have to wait on hold or keep calling for hours just to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not assured to ride the same day or even the next day.
Really?
And the proposed standard, so we said to the government, set a deadline by which we get two things. Someone who's eligible for paratransit, if they make a call, that their call will get answered within, let's say, 10 minutes.
All right.
I mean, if you call a cab, you don't have to wait that long, but
yeah.
But let's have an end deadline by which you got to wait on hold. And the second thing is, let's have a same-day ride guarantee that, if you call within 5 hours or whatever, you're going to get a ride that day.
Yeah.
And all the government isn't proposing anything for the time for making your call, having your call answered. And all it says in the proposed standard for a ride is that you're guaranteed the same day ride where available.
Really?
Where available means maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't.
It means we don't give a damn, really.
It's a guarantee of nothing.
Yeah.
So that's one example. Another example is we have a problem that there are not enough accessible taxis on the road. Now, we don't expect every individual taxi car owner, which is, they're often sole proprietors, to go out and trade their car in an inaccessible car for an accessible one, like tomorrow or whatever. We recognize there are costs associated with that, and we're realistic. But we say, look, why don't we require municipalities to implement strategies to get more accessible cabs on the roads? Like, for example, what if your city had a policy or implemented a policy that every new cab that's going to go on the road. Every time someone comes forward and says, give me a license to get a new car, bring a new cab on the road, I'm going to be a new taxi operation. They should be required, given only to people who undertake to provide accessible cabs.
And an accessible cab is basically what, a minivan?
Yeah, it's often their minivan.
With a lift, right?
Which, by the way, are also fabulous when you're at the, trying to get a ride out to the airport or whatever, and you've got kids or you got a lot of suitcases.
It requires a lift, too, doesn't it?
Some of them are, yeah, there's design of them where they have a lift or a ramp system.
Oh, so a ramp, they, okay.
Yeah. But we'd also like to see the government implementing strategies to make it cheaper to get these things. You know, if we buy...
Yeah.
If the taxi industry buys collectively several hundred cabs a year, and if we went to one of the car companies, like how about one that we just bailed out, like GM, and said, look, we saved your posterior. Why don't you come up with a cheaper bulk rate for accessible cabs?
Yeah.
Let's see what they can do for us.
Yeah.
You know, this is where government should show some leadership, and that's what we'd like to see. I'll give you just one more area where those two barriers affect people with physical disabilities largely. Here's one that's relevant for people who are dyslexic or who have vision loss. We use computers to read to us.
Right.
And they can go on the Internet, and they can read websites, but the websites have to be designed in a way that can work with our screen readers. And a lot of them are, and a lot of them aren't.
Yeah.
There are international standards that have been established back in 2008 after consultation with all the high-tech whiz-bang guys for what is needed to make a website accessible. And we would like to see this required of government, of local government, of universities and colleges, of big business and gradually of medium and smaller businesses. Mm. Now, the government has agreed with us in principle that this should be required, but they've done two things that are really weird. The first thing is they put in some ridiculous timelines. They're going to give some, you know, up to like 8-9 years to meet this standard, by which time the standard will be out of date.
Yep.
And they also are proposing sort of a
stopping... Isn't that like the deficit?
Pardon me? Yeah, exactly. The other thing they're proposing is that for the first few years, organizations other than the provincial government should meet like a halfway house standard.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, they'll have to meet a higher standard,
yeah.
Which means they'll have to go and train their information technology guys twice.
Yeah.
It seems to be, we're not talking here about going back and retrofitting all the archival data on their websites. We're talking about making sure that new information that's posted on the internet for our use in business or access to goods and services is posted in a way that people can read. And by the way, when you meet our accessibility needs, they often help other people. I had to fight a battle to get a particular website not to use PDFs because they don't work well with some of them don't work well with our adaptive technology.
Well, you have no idea how you've warmed my heart. I hate PDF to death.
Well, when I won this battle, I have a colleague who does not have a disability who thanked me because he uses a BlackBerry, and PDFs are not very easily read on a BlackBerry.
Yeah.
So creating access for us often helps everybody.
Yeah.
So these are strategies. So we're trying to get the government
to... That's the law in the states, though, apparently, right? They already have mandated that every website be accessible.
Well, you know, a couple of major organizations in the states have been sued recently, and there have been major settlements against Target, the Target store, and against a number of other stores. There are universities who are being sued because they don't provide accessible information technology for students with disabilities.
Yeah.
Listeners will find this interesting. You know that we used to go to the store and just, you know, you wanted to buy something, you dealt with a human being called a cashier.
Yeah. Introduce me to someone who likes self-checkouts, able or not.
Yeah. Lots of people can't stand them because they're hard to use, but they also have accessibility problems. So we want the government's standard to require that new electronic self-serve kiosks be made accessible.
Right.
No, I'm not, you know, let's just, as time evolves, as they get new ones, let's make sure we can use them. And frankly, that's beneficial for all customers. You know, the banks are increasingly doing it.
Yeah.
There are a number of banks that have accessible bank machines.
Yeah.
Not just for people in wheelchairs, but I'm blind. I do all my banking on a bank machine that I can use on my own. I bring my own earphones. I plug them in.
Yeah.
I can withdraw money or do whatever it is I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So there's... The technology's out there. It can be done. It's a question of just making sure it is done without us having to sue each of these organizations. Well, the government's initial proposal last summer was really weak. They've strengthened it somewhat in response to our request, but not enough.
Okay.
So we're carrying forward trying to make the message clear.
These kiosks are the son of... You remember the Chryslers of the mid-70s? Your door is... A jar.
Right. Your door's not a door, it's a jar.
Yeah.
But so that we're trying to intervene now to prevent barriers in the future.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're trying to prevent new barriers. And where there are existing barriers, we're trying to get them fixed along reasonable timelines. People are used to thinking that Canada's sort of really ahead and progressive, and we are in areas like healthcare, but we are way behind the United States on areas like accessibility. While the U.S. has a way to go, they don't have to go as far as we have to go. We got to play serious catch-up.
Yeah, they have the tools to enforce it. We don't.
And they've actually made progress in a number of important areas where we haven't yet. So we are used to congratulating ourselves about some of our progressive social policies in Canada. This is an area where we are lagging behind. And I'll tell you, accessibility actually is not only good for us folks with disabilities. It's good for business.
Yeah.
There was an independent study done by the Martin Prosperity Institute last summer, associated with the University of Toronto, I believe, and it's up on our website. We had nothing to do with the study itself, but we were happy with the results. And it documents that the more you do accessibility, the better it is for business, and the more you've got inaccessibility, the worse it is for our economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. is...
Martin Institute, you say?
Yeah, Martin Prosperity Institute.
Okay.
And the report's up on our website on our What's New page.
Oh, good.
But, you know, the European Union is going in the direction of accessibility. The U.S., you know, if people want to do business with these these huge markets.
Well, and growing market with the baby boomers getting older.
Oh, but that's the other thing. I mean, everybody either has a disability now or is going to get one later.
If they're lucky, yeah.
So we're just, all you got to do is grow old.
Yeah.
Live long enough to grow old, and rest assured, if your hearing doesn't get worse, your eyesight's going to get worse. And if your eyesight doesn't get worse, your legs are not going to walk upstairs so easily.
Yeah.
So we're trying to address them. You know, you're only one of the most accessible communities I've ever been in. This is actually really interesting. Go down to Palm Beach or Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Really?
It's the snowbird area, right?
Right.
So who are the snowbirds? They're retired folks. You know, they don't just have one or two disabled parking spots in a shopping center. They got like a whole ton of them.
Right.
And they have, you know, level access into restaurants and stores, because if you want the business, you better make it available.
Yeah. Yeah. Good idea.
So it's this is the kind of thing, it's not a left versus right issue.
Yeah.
It's not a, you know, all parties have an interest in this. And we ultimately, in 2005, we persuaded all three political parties to vote unanimously for this law.
Yeah.
And in this, in every election, you know, each election, we've been raising these issues, and we ask all the parties to make commitments for us.
Yeah. Two questions before you go.
Yes, sir.
How do we address the fact that the McGuinty government has made the Ministry of Community and Social Services a captain of the administration of this law and quashed already many AODA complaints against the ministry, quashed by the ministry?
Well, let me take that in two parts. The government initially didn't have this whole thing issue with the Ministry of Community and Social Services. They moved it there in 2005. And on the one hand, we've called for there to be an independent new ministry dealing with accessibility, and the government has not agreed with us. but last year, before I carry on, I just going to tell you, as for the ministry quashing complaints against it, I can't comment on that because I got no information on it. So
right.
I'm not aware of it.
Mine's third hand too, but it's pretty reliable. It comes from the Ontario government.
But in any event, one of the things that happened when this law was passed back in 2005, when they were developing it, is we said to the government, okay, if you're setting a 20-year deadline to meet full accessibility, we don't want to find out that everybody goes along their merry way till like Christmas Eve of the 19th year and then wake up and say, oh my, we didn't do what we had to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So we wanted some safeguards built in. And the government said, what safeguards do you want? We said, among other things, we want an independent review of the law every few years to see how it's going.
Yeah.
So 4 years into the law, it was passed in 2005, 4 years into the law was 2009. The government had to appoint an independent inquiry.
All right.
And they did. Okay. They appointed a fellow named Charles Beer, who was a Liberal cabinet minister under the David Peterson government in the 80s.
Right.
And we thought he was a good pick. We had no input into the particular individual. We found out what the name was when it was made public. But we worked closely with him and thought he's a bright guy, he's a smart guy, he's a caring guy, and he understands the issues. And Charles Beer did the review. He talked to the business community, talked to governments, he talked to the disability community, and he rendered a report early in February of 2010. The government studied it and made it public in May of 2010. It's up on our website, the Charles Beer Independent Review of the Disability Act.
We got to get to this website. Yeah.
Well, this is really important. He accepted our concerns. He agreed with us that the government essentially needs to breathe new life into the implementation of this law. He said the government needs to show new leadership, that it's not handling the law as effectively as it should.
Right.
He didn't cast blame on anyone or say anybody didn't care or whatever, but he said the government really needs to shake up its house and go about it a new way. He made a number of really good recommendations, unfortunately, nowhere near as much as what we wanted him to recommend, but we endorsed this report. Unfortunately, the only people who didn't listen to him was the government that appointed him.
Mm-hmm.
We said we need a new ministry. He said, at the very least, he didn't go for our idea of a new ministry, but he said, why don't you give him a new deputy minister who can lead this through the whole Ontario government bureaucracy?
Right.
Government wouldn't do that.
No.
So that most of what he's recommended, the government's either not accepted or deferred and said they'll study later or something. But
sub-question then, do we need a new government?
Well, we don't take a position on who you should vote for or who you should vote against. What we do in each election...
Kind of a rhetorical question, yeah.
No, I know, but what we'll do in this election, as we have in past, is we will put together a list of commitments that we will ask all three parties to make.
Right.
It will be the same list. We will... Because we're nonpartisan.
Right.
And we will then...
I thought you meant the same list as before.
No. There'll be some same things, some new things. But we will then circulate it to the three parties. We'll ask for their commitments, and then we will let, during the election campaign and so on, we'll make public what their positions are, and we will urge people to consider this issue when they decide who to vote for.
Oh, well, we'll announce those positions.
And
we don't say
vote for this guy or defeat that guy.
No. Well, we don't particularly say vote for this guy, but we will occasionally say this guy seems to have his foot in his mouth all the time.
Right.
Okay. And the second question was to encourage people who think they may not take advantage of the AODA because they don't have a transportation or an employment or an information issue at this time. What path can people follow other than asking the Ministry of Community and Social Services? They come in under the wire somehow at this point in time. Where does someone with a complaint take it? You said to an individual lawyer.
Either you go to an individual lawyer or you go to the Human Rights Legal Support Center if it's something that can be brought under the Human Rights Code, and they can advise you how best to handle it. That's for anyone who thinks they're facing a disability barrier or issue.
Okay. My understanding is that the Ontario Human Rights Commission does not like having to enforce the AODA, but that the Canadian Human Rights Commission is more than willing if there's no conflict.
Well, it's more complicated than that. The Human Rights Commission in Ontario is no longer mandated to deal with individual complaints. The McGuinty government, over our strong objection, took that power away from them and now require you to bring your individual discrimination complaint right to the Human Rights Tribunal on your own.
Right.
They said that they would provide free legal services. There is a legal clinic that they have funded that you could bring an individual barrier to, and that's the Ontario Human Rights Legal Support Center.
Okay.
The problem with that center that we understand is that they're underfunded, and therefore, just like the Human Rights Code Commission was, and therefore there's a long lineup to get in, and they don't necessarily advise or act for everybody who tries to phone them because of the lineup.
Right. Now, I understand Harper has failed to appoint new members to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, so that they may, though they're already facing the same situation in terms of funding and staff as the Ontario Human Rights Commission, and they have a few other issues going on there, too.
I can't speak as focused a way on the federal situation because
okay.
Our coalition exists to deal with the Ontario jurisdiction. That's not to say the federal jurisdiction isn't important,
right.
But we've got our plate full and overflowing just dealing with Ontario. And just so people understand, our coalition, sometimes we get calls or emails from people asking us for advice, and we're not equipped to give advice on individual barriers. We can just tell people what I just told you, which is to go and get advice from people who are in a position to do that. We're volunteers, and we've, as I said, we're amply busy just trying to fight to get this law enforced.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from my own experience, lawyers are reluctant to work with a law that they haven't encountered before, certainly on a commission basis, because they don't see the size of the penalties, they don't see the potential of the rewards. So there needs to be like a place to refer people for this kind of stuff, you know, to lawyers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Where do we go for the future of supporting and carrying on the initiative of the AODA Alliance?
Okay, again, I'll wrap up where we started for people who just tuned in. If you want to learn more about us,
yeah,
we send out periodic email updates of what's going on, and we offer people action tips and let them know what the latest developments are. Just if you want to sign up for our email updates, just send an email to aodafeedback@gmail.com. I'll repeat that, aodafeedback@gmail.com, and just say, please sign me up. And again, we don't give your names out to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to learn more about the history of what we've been involved in, or to see our past updates, go to our website, which is aodaalliance.org.
Well, it's been a very thorough interview, and I'm grateful for your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me on your program.
Okay, thanks, David.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the full news stories that we read to you, but condensations or abridgments from the newspapers that we identify in the broadcast. First item, death of teen in home invasion called puzzling. A severely disabled teenage girl has died in mysterious circumstances, with her mother telling police the tragedy was sparked by a daytime robbery attempt by ski-masked intruders in business suits. Emergency crews discovered the dying 16-year-old girl in the Scarborough residence after the mother called 911 around 11:30 Saturday, February 19th. They arrived in time to take her to hospital and put her on life support, but she did not survive. An autopsy was scheduled, though the girl did not suffer any visible injuries. She was fragile. The child suffers from severe mental and physical disability and was located without vital signs, Detective Skubik said, declining to specify the specific nature of the disabilities. The girl's 40-year-old mother told police she answered a knock at the door, which occurred approximately 10 minutes before the 911 call was placed. When she opened the door, she told police in walked two men in gloves, suits, overcoats, and ski masks. One of the intruders is said to have brandished a handgun. The men demanded an unspecified package be produced, said Detective Skubik. But with that directive, police were told one man escorted mother all through the rooms in the house, opening drawers, cupboards, and closets in search of this unknown package, he said. Almost as suddenly as the search began, it ended. The men verbalized that they must have the wrong house and fled the scene, Detective Skubik explained, and that was when the mother told police she ran to her daughter and discovered that the child was not breathing. Police are treating the teenager's death as a suspicious death, not a homicide. They have identified no suspects. That by Colin Freeze in the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Family has no right to sue SIU, court told. Simone Wellington was jolted by a gunshot coming from the parking lot of her Scarborough apartment building early one morning in June 2006. What she didn't know was that police had just killed her 15-year-old son, Dwayne Christian, who had been driving a stolen van. But then Wellington discovered the SIU hadn't interviewed Constable Steve Darnley, the officer who fired the fatal shot. She also learned the SIU cleared police of wrongdoing before receiving a report from an autopsy. Wellington and her daughter, Alexis, filed a negligence lawsuit against the SIU, relying on a 2007 decision from the Supreme Court that opened the door to lawsuits against police for incompetent criminal investigations. A judge pressed Wellington's lawyer to explain why he encouraged them to pursue a novel claim that's likely to result in minimal damages and threatens to turn into a public inquiry into the SIU, especially when a more conventional remedy, a lawsuit for damages, could be a faster path to getting answers. Said Peter Rosenthal, the way the SIU handled investigation had made Wellington feel as though her son was worthless. To be honest with you, sir, he told the judge, I will tell you that my client was enraged by the SIU investigation. Justice Michael Moldaver suggested allowing families to sue could further the integrity of these investigations and ensure officers and SIU investigators are not playing footsie with one another. That by Tracy Tyler, legal affairs reporter in The Star. Audits target housing agency. Two sources familiar with Jeffrey Griffith's probe of Toronto Community Housing Corp. refused to divulge details but said it will shake up the arm's-length agency still recovering from a probe into the death of elderly tenant Al Gosling. Griffith said he could not elaborate until his report is made public. The TCHC would not elaborate either. However, Councillor Shelley Carroll, member of the city's audit committee, has learned it has two parts. One relating to TCHC's procurement procedures, the other dealing with expense improprieties. The agency, one of the largest residential landlords in North America, has come under fire in recent years. In October of 2009, Gosling, a pensioner on a fixed income, died from an illness caught in a Toronto shelter. The 82-year-old had been evicted from his community housing building after failing to provide documents showing he needed rent subsidies. Former Chief Justice Patrick Lesage, asked by TCHC to look into the senior's eviction and subsequent death, criticized the agency for a heavy-handed approach. James Poisson and David Ryder with files from Donovan Vincent in the Toronto Star. Child welfare accountability needed. Jeffrey Baldwin was a toddler who was given to his maternal grandparents in a family adoption, despite the fact his grandmother had been convicted of second-degree murder in the death of her first daughter many years earlier. Two other children had been seized, and his grandfather had been found guilty of assaulting children only 6 years previously. The emaciated 5-year-old died from shock and bacterial pneumonia brought on by malnutrition. At death, 5-year-old Jeffrey weighed just 21 pounds. Beaten to death by his father and stepmother 11 months after arriving in their household, Randall Dooley had 13 broken ribs, a lacerated liver and fractured vertebra, and a tooth in his stomach. When his teacher had earlier brought the child's bruises to the attention of the school principal, that man had called the CAS to report the suspected abuse and was told, as he recounted from the witness stand, that the CAS was not going to attend. A couple of weeks ago, a Hamilton couple were convicted of abuse and endangerment over two youngsters found living in a locked basement room after police responded to a 911 call made by the younger boy, who was all of 2 years old. In that case, the social worker had been in the basement mere hours before police arrived and noticed nothing amiss, not the stench of feces and urine, not the two rats caught in a trap. At a trial, the worker said she'd had a bad head cold that day, so was unable to smell anything. A Children's Aid complaint brochure specifically disallows complaints directed at the CAS or the Ontario Child and Family Services Review Board, the CFSRB, in matters currently before the courts or that the courts have already decided, and matters that fall under other decision-making processes under the Child and Family Services Act or the Labour Relations Act. The province has a child advocate office, but it cannot compel cooperation from any agency. Ontario is the only province that does not grant the provincial ombudsman authority to investigate child welfare agencies such as the CAS, the CCAS, or the JFCS. In Ontario, the child protection system is exempt from oversight, says Andre Marin, the Ontario ombudsman, whose annual report this year will again call for changes to the Ombudsman Act, pleading for child welfare agencies to be brought under his office's jurisdiction. These are powerful agencies that get $1.4 billion a year from the government, says Marin. They get very defensive, ferociously defensive, and they bring out their well-oiled PR machinery. Citizen groups have also been fomenting for legislative changes. They're usually portrayed as lunatics or a fringe minority, observes Marin, but they have legitimate issues. I can't think of any area more ripe for oversight than child welfare. Children die and no one takes responsibility, no one answers the important questions. It's just so sad. That by Rosie DiMano in the Toronto Star. Star investigation. Home care for elderly a mirage, says daughter. Susan Bozak was in Cincinnati the morning her father had the stroke. She was talking to a class of grade 5 students about the value and meaning of aging, part of the work she does through her foundation, the Legacy Project. When her cell phone rang, Susan told her frantic mother to press the panic button in the kitchen, and by the time she drove 10 hours home, her father was in Markham Stouffville Hospital, where doctors did not expect him to survive. But he did. The physical impact was severe. He had problems swallowing. Each meal took an hour. After 2 weeks in hospital, the family was told Bozak's bed was needed so he would be discharged and sent home. His colitis flared up, and Bozak spent several more weeks in the hospital as Susan tried to decide where he should live. From the work that she's done on aging, Susan said a nursing home experience would break whatever spirit he had left. She said hospital staff told her the Central Community Care Access Center, or CCAC, had a program for high-needs seniors that would give 21 hours of personal support care each week, along with regular physiotherapy, speech therapy, and nutritional counseling. Her father's new condition was complicated by her mother's dementia. Bozak had been his wife's caregiver. Now they both needed help. As two high-needs seniors, she was sure they would each receive 21 hours of care. But once we got into the community, the CCAC said they would need more assessment. maybe they wouldn't qualify, which just blew my mind. How much more high need do you need to be? We were begging, she said. Susan and her husband were shocked to discover the weekly physiotherapy sessions the hospital described were not forthcoming. They were like, okay, we'll give you 6 sessions. Use them well. The physiotherapist sent by the CCAC was rushed and, Susan said, not skilled in communicating with a stroke victim. Her father ended up being terrified of the encounters. She hired a private physiotherapist who came twice a week at the cost of $120 per session. They had the same problems with a CCAC speech therapist and ended up hiring a private one at $120 for an hour session twice a week. She said a CCAC case manager came in every 3 months to reassess the hours they could receive. Susan said she begged every visit to keep her dad's hours at 21 a week. I remember sitting and crying at one point. It was humiliating. It was a terrible financial burden. We simply don't have any more money. We were going to burn out. A spokesperson for the CCAC said it tries to give outstanding care to all of its clients. Susan said the system put incredible pressure on the case managers to cut hours. I feel lied to by the system. If this isn't a priority, then say so. But don't say our priority is aging at home, and then tell me that even though the government has announced this new program, there is no funding to implement it. It's a mirage of a program. And that by Moira Welsh at the Toronto Star. 3 hours per week for Mom. 90 years old. When Su Ping Soi fell and fractured her cheekbone, her family decided it was time to call for help. The 90-year-old suffers from dementia. Her daughter-in-law, Maggie Wu, exhausted from working as Soi's full-time caregiver, called the Central East Community Care Access Center last summer and asked for help. They, the Access Center, said they didn't have enough money, so they could not give us any hours, said Soi's daughter, Angela Soi. But in September, they were offered 3 hours a week from a personal support worker. No more. The family took it, grateful that their mom would get 3 baths a week, one each time the personal support worker visited. It wasn't enough to make a difference in the life of Soi's daughter-in-law, Wu. To get time to clean the house and go grocery shopping, her daughter-in-law takes her twice a week to an adult day program for seniors with dementia at the Care First Seniors and Community Services Association on Victoria Park Avenue. It's a community support group, one of 750 not-for-profit agencies across Ontario that operate using volunteers, client co-payments, and a shoestring budget to provide care for 750,000 seniors and their families. Of Ontario's $43.5 billion in health care spending last year, only 1%, or $540 million, was spent on community support groups. It doesn't replace what they had hoped to get from home care, Angelina said, but it makes a difference. We are very thankful. That from the Toronto Star, again by Moira Welsh. Home care funding hijacked. Thousands of aging seniors who do not receive home care are ending up in hospital or on waiting lists for scarce nursing home beds, two expensive prospects that cash-strapped Ontario cannot afford. The solution? The province has to redistribute some money to community care access centers and community agencies that want to care for seniors who have stayed out of hospital and are trying to live at home. Experts believe the best way to support the majority of seniors is in their homes, and that led to the McGuinty government's launch of its Aging at Home strategy that vowed to transform community health care services so that seniors can live healthy, independent lives in their own homes. But soon after it was announced, the province began pushing the home care funding to another plan called ER/ALC. The goal was and is to cut wait times in emergency rooms and to rid hospitals of patients referred to as alternative level of care patients. Almost 1 in 5 patients in Ontario hospitals don't need to be there, and they cost taxpayers $450 a day, compared to as little as $50 a day for home care. A nursing home bed is $130 a day. But increasingly, the ER/ALC plan is hijacking the Aging at Home plan. In the first year, an estimated 20% of funding went to ER/ALC, By the last year, the third year, almost all of it was focused on ER/ALC. The demand for home care is so heavy that workers are swamped, says Margaret Mottershead, Chief Executive Officer of the Ontario Association of Community Care Access Centres. I don't think there's enough money going to home care, Mottershead said. In a pre-budget submission, her association is asking the Ontario government to commit to at least $92 million more annually to keep up with home care demands. Asking such large organizations to operate without stability, with last-minute funding injected from time to time, is like forcing a plane to land on a postage stamp, said the association's February 1st submission to a legislative committee. University of Toronto professor Paul Williams says the trend away from preventive home care is incredibly short-sighted. In spending more money to get people out of the hospital, you will now have a lot less resources to keep people out in the first place, Williams said. Kathy Szabo, Chief Executive Officer of the Central Community Care Access Centre, said funding limits mean they are forced to make tough decisions. The expectations of seniors, Szabo said, will have to change. Does every individual resident of Ontario think they are entitled to have a personal support worker come to their home when they get old, 3 times a week to get their house cleaned and have a bath? Szabo asked. For each high-need senior, the Central CCAC serves, another 20 with low or moderate needs are declined, referred instead to community support service organizations. But the community groups are struggling too, said Susan Thorninghead of the Ontario Community Support Association. Of Ontario's $43.5 billion in healthcare spending last year, only 1%, or $540 million, was spent on community support groups, she said. We are just a rounding error in the health budget. It's hard to get a lot of attention when you're that small, she said. That from the Toronto Star, Moira Welsh and Teresa Boyle. And coming soon to a daycare or seniors home near you, new TB strains seen in shelters. A study has found tuberculosis strains not known to be circulating in the city are seen in Toronto's shelter system. The authors say the report offers yet more evidence for giving greater priority to tuberculosis control to prevent an outbreak of drug-resistant TB in the shelter system, which would put public health at risk. The study to be published in the journal Emerging Infectious Diseases looked at tuberculosis cases in Toronto's homeless population between 1998 and 2007. Most of the 91 homeless individuals identified with active TB had highly contagious, advanced disease, and 19% died within 12 months of diagnosis. That death rate is alarmingly high, about 3 to 4 times higher than what is expected, said study lead author Dr. Cameron Kahn, an infectious disease physician and scientist at St. Michael's Hospital. The death rate also has remained unchanged over the last decade, he said. Kahn said the study's timely because of the approaching 10-year anniversary of the 2001 death of Joseph Tegesser, who died of tuberculosis while living in a city shelter during a 17-month-long outbreak that also infected 15 other homeless people. A 2004 inquest into his death made 13 recommendations for reducing TB transmission among the homeless. But Kahn and Dr. Gardam said two key recommendations, provincial funding for a centralized TB clinic system and improvement of shelter ventilation system, remain unfulfilled. Gardam is infection control chief at the University Health Network and head of Toronto Western's TB clinic. A centralized clinic system would ensure TB patients were treated by physicians who have experience with the disease. When diagnosed too late and given inappropriate treatment, patients are more likely to develop antibiotic resistance, have permanent lung damage, relapse later in life, die, and pass on the disease to others around them. Health Ministry spokesman Andrew Morrison said a document outlining best practices for ventilation systems in shelters and drop-in centers has been produced and distributed. Again, from the Toronto Star, that article by Megan Ogilvy, health reporter. Survey shows Ontarians fear surging hydro rates. The vast majority of Ontarians fear ever higher energy bills, even though the government is scrambling to help with hydro discounts, a Toronto Star Vision Critical Angus Reid poll has found. In a survey that could signal trouble for Premier Dalton McGuinty's Liberals with an October election looming, 72% of Ontario residents are bracing for most costly bills this winter. There is little awareness of the new Ontario Clean Energy Benefit. That's the much-hyped 10% hydro rate discount, which took effect January 1st and will cost the Treasury more than $1 billion annually for the next 5 years. Only 21% of Ontarians believe Queen's Park is trying to keep heating and energy costs down. Another 40% say they're unsure the province has done anything. Marsha Mason, 38, was stunned to see the Toronto hydro bill for a two-bedroom Danforth Avenue apartment jump by almost a third in a year. She has electric heating, but no washer or dryer. Cold weather aside, Mason said the HST and new time-of-use pricing for electricity appear to be the biggest causes of the hike. About 40% of those surveyed were in Ontario. That story by Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief at the Star. Hospital bed found for GTA man. Star gets action. Patient admitted after Star revealed he was stuck in U.S. following cardiac arrest. After lying in limbo for more than 2 months, Bipinderoy Joshi now rests in a Toronto hospital bed his wife feared he would never see. The 67-year-old Woodbridge man returned to Canada after spending 10 weeks stuck in a St. Louis, Missouri hospital. He suffered a cardiac arrest while on vacation in December. His wife, Kokila Joshi, was told by hospital after hospital in GTA that there were no beds here. Her insurance company couldn't find a spot either. Then, after an article in The Star told Bipinderoy's story, his wife got a phone call from North York General Hospital. They said, "There is a bed for you." "I couldn't believe it," said an ecstatic Kokila. "It happened so fast. I said, oh my God, I hit the jackpot," explained Donna Ritchie, lead of critical care for Central LIHN. She learned about the Joshi's treatment only after the Star story generated buzz among communications people in the network. She made a few phone calls and found a bed within hours. "It's tight, but we were able to scoot him in." After she got the call, Kokila immediately broke the news to her husband, who has said little since December, but uttered "home" to his wife a couple of weeks ago. "I told him, we are going home." "That made his eyes so wide," said Kokila, who had traveled to St. Louis to be with her husband after his cardiac arrest on December 8th. The hospitals had said their ICU beds were full. The flu made beds hard to come by this year, and that patients in their own emergency departments had priority. Ontario Health Minister Deb Matthews said last week she couldn't intervene and urged the insurance company to do its job and find a bed. Kokila, herself a nurse, said she was so stressed by the situation that she suffered a heart attack in late December and was hospitalized with her husband for 3 days. Kokila said her husband has a long recovery ahead. He now breathes with the help of a ventilator and is being fed through a gastric feeding tube. He's awake and can follow simple commands. "He opens his eyes. He moves his head around. He squeezed my arm," Kokila said. "The smallest things keep her hopeful." And that from the Toronto Star, Amy Dempsey, staff reporter with files from Teresa Boyle. Ontario, worst province for repatriating patients. It's harder and harder to find local hospital beds for Canadians who fall ill abroad, insurer says. Dr. Ron Mayer, CEO of World Travel Protection, a Toronto-based insurance company, says a shortage of hospital beds, particularly in Ontario, has driven insurance companies increasingly to hire professional bed finders, nurses who have the expertise and contacts to find beds. Mayer made the comments 3 days after a bed was finally found for a Woodbridge man at North York General Hospital. Bipinderoy Joshi had been stuck in a Missouri hospital since suffering a cardiac arrest while on vacation in early December. "It is becoming harder for insurance companies to do their jobs because there are just not enough beds, particularly intensive care beds, available at certain times of the year," Mayer said. Insurance companies employ medical consultants such as Mayer, who will contact hospitals. If that doesn't work, the insurer will try hospitals further afield, but often these facilities reject patients who aren't in their catchment area, Mayer said. Often the first response is, no, we don't have anything available. Call back. Or we will put you on the list if something does become available. Mayer was not involved in Joshi's case, but said the man's 10-week wait was quite out of the ordinary. He said finding a local bed usually takes no more than 2 weeks. And that by Teresa Boyle, health reporter at the Toronto Star. And in a little better news, Miracle Boy baffles doctors. According to conventional medical wisdom, 3-year-old Chase Britton shouldn't be able to walk. The fact that he even breathes on his own is nothing short of remarkable. Chase doesn't have a cerebellum, the part of the brain that plays a crucial role in motor control, coordination, balance, and emotional function. Chase has defied all of our expectations, said Dr. Luther Robinson, director of clinical genetics at the Women and Children's Hospital of Buffalo, who has been treating Chase since he was born. Heather Britton, Chase's mom, says her son seemed like any other normal baby at first, except for the fact he was born legally blind. But when Chase was about 6 months old, he started having trouble with his motor skills, she said. Doctors ordered Chase to undergo an MRI. Further tests revealed that Chase simply didn't have a cerebellum at all. What makes the case even more bizarre is that prenatal images of Chase showed that he did have a cerebellum, but it just disappeared when he was born. Knowing he had a cerebellum, there should have been some tissue left, Britton said, and if there were some kind of injury, the rest of the brain would show evidence of that, but the rest of the brain is absolutely fine. Everyone is baffled. Doctors also discovered he was born without a pons, the part of the brain that helps automatically regulate some of the body basic functions such as sleeping, breathing, and swallowing. Yet he seems to have no problem with any of those. He can now stand up by himself with the help of nearby furniture. He walks with the aid of a walker. He laughs. He signs. He's potty training. His vocabulary has expanded now to 75 words, a number that's growing daily as Chase imitates the parents who ensure he's constantly stimulated. He surprises us all the time with things he'll just come out with, said Britton. He's not at age level for speech development, but he's constantly progressing. Said Dr. Audrey Duplessis, chief of fetal and transitional medicine at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., who's been working with Chase for the past 2 years, he clearly is doing much better than we would have expected based on conventional wisdom. Dr. Robinson says Chase's case is teaching doctors and researchers to be cautiously optimistic when it comes to diagnosing patients because kids don't always meet what the statistical data would suggest. That by Kenyon Wallace in the Toronto Star. And that's all the news we have for Disrespect this week. But come back next week, we will have more. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four. Not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.